The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's been a dissonance between the administration's pretty strong focus on limiting Chinese power in the UN and other multilateral forums, with the fact that overall it still continues to treat those forums with a high degree of disdain. And I think that this crisis is really showing up the inherent contradictions in that approach. It isn't meaningful for the US to try and marginalize China in the UN system if it's not really going to be able to lead in the UN system itself. And I think right at the moment, a lot of diplomats in New York are looking at Washington, they're looking to US, and they're just seeing a bit of a void. In the absence of US leadership, the French are working very hard to get something in the Security Council. You know, even tiny countries like Liechtenstein played an important role in pulling together a General Assembly resolution. But without the US at the center of the UN response, it's not clear how much political credibility that the whole response can maintain.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for April 7th, 2020. The devastating effects of the coronavirus COVID-19 are being felt in nearly every corner of the world, with little regard for national borders or boundaries. In many ways, this makes it the exact sort of transnational threat that the United Nations is supposed to help address. Yet the response across various UN institutions has been inconsistent at best. To understand how the United Nations is responding to the coronavirus crisis and why, I spoke with two people who know it like few others. UN resident correspondent and CBS News analyst Pamela Falk, and UN Director for the International Crisis Group, Richard Gowan. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 531, The United Nations and the Coronavirus Crisis.
Pamela, let me start with you. Give us a sense of what it's like at UN headquarters in New York right now in the midst of the coronavirus crisis. How is it impacting the organization's day-to-day operations?
Well, Scott, the UN is virtually all remote at this point. It's virtual. The UN Secretary General's press conferences, and he's had quite a few. He really has stepped up to the plate on a lot of these issues, the ceasefire, the new funds, all of it, have been remote. So there's the daily noon briefing, and that is remote. And the Security Council, interestingly, tried to stay as long as they could. The building is still open for essential services, but they have now gone remote. So ironically, China is the president of the Security Council for the month of April, and they have put all of the meetings through to the end of April on video conference. And so that's really what's going on. Nonetheless, there was these launch of these two new funds by the Secretary General, one that called for 10% of the global GDP, or almost $9 trillion. There's been other calls for other things. And the humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, has also been very active. So there's additional issues on the finances of the UN, but it really got quiet and then it became almost totally remote. The only essential services right now are UN TV to coordinate the remote calls. And from time to time, the Secretary General does go in to tape something from the UN studio. but all of the meetings have become remote. And that is because there have been several diplomats who have tested positive, they said 80 in the organization altogether. It's not broken down to New York, but there have been diplomats, staff, and UN press corps all testing positive for coronavirus. So they basically said, stay at home.
How sustainable is this sort of arrangement in the long run for the United Nations? Are there essential functions that they are going to have to be able to do in person at some point in the near future? And perhaps more importantly, of course, we have, I think it's the 75th General Assembly coming up in September, which usually is a huge event where people come from all around the world, not just the representatives themselves, but advocates, diplomats, politicians, to descend on New York for really a week or two of what's often called UN Week. Has there been any thinking about how that's going to be handled in light of coronavirus?
Well, the many, many things have been canceled, but the UN General Assembly takes place at the end of September. And so to this day, they have said they haven't canceled that yet. And of course, as you say, it is the 75th anniversary. And the idea here is the UN is as vital, if not more than ever. So part of the question is, how is the UN functioning and being able to do all these things to unite the international community? And also, the humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, talked about this boomerang effect. And his idea was, after the developed countries are able to get past their surges of coronavirus or COVID-19, then it will hit the poorer countries, and it will bounce back, battering the countries in the north, the developed countries that have taken such care. So there's also, all of this is taking a lot of money. So the expenses related to coronavirus and the inability, Scott, of countries to pay has presented a new crisis. There was a leaked memo that I received this week that says the UN is facing a dire liquidity crisis, and that even peacekeeping forces around the world, the current cash position of about $1.4 billion is barely sufficient to maintain operations around the globe until June, and the cash balance of the whole organization dropped from $200 million to $50 million in 3 months. So they're spending a lot of money to make sure that countries are getting the kind of nutrition aid and children's aid and education aid, all that that existed before the coronavirus pandemic. But they're worried that pandemic will outsource and then take away some of the resources.
Richard, let me come to you and ask you about the UN Security Council specifically. The Security Council is really, in a lot of ways, the heart of the United Nations organization. It's the body that's empowered to address threats to international security in a way that's binding on member states to abide by their directives. But you've described recently an article in the New York Times, I noted, that it's been really struck around the coronavirus crisis by what you described, I believe, as symbolic disunity, specifically between China and the United States and the way that they are framing the coronavirus itself and the response to it. Give us a sense of how the UN Security Council has operated in this coronavirus era and how these political debates may be impacting its effectiveness as an institution.
Well, at a technical level, as Pat was saying, the council has done okay. It has worked out how to hold meetings virtually, and it's not perfect, but I think pretty much everyone on the planet is struggling with virtual meetings at the moment. So I don't think we should criticize the council too much for that. On the other hand, it's been a political mess because the majority of council members think that the body should at least make some sort of declaration about the need for cooperation around this crisis. And I think more specifically about the potential security risks associated with COVID-19. If, for example, it starts to undermine governments in fragile states. The problem is that while the majority of council members want to see some sort of action, and France actually tabled a resolution fairly early on in March, the US and China have really fallen out over how to approach the problem. The US, American diplomats, are under instruction to get references to this being the Wuhan virus into any multilateral text. And that's something that has come from Washington and is really poisoning debate because the Chinese simply won't accept that sort of language. So when the French tabled their resolution, or when Estonia tried to pull together a council statement on the pandemic, it was impossible to get a product. This week, there's another push to get a Security Council resolution looking at what COVID means for peace and security. Tunisia is leading that, but it's still not clear that the Americans and the Chinese are going to put aside this rather silly blame game. There's also a bit of an issue with the Russians. The Russians have seen that they have an opportunity here to attack UN sanctions. And they're arguing that on humanitarian grounds, the UN should suspend sanctions on countries like Iran and DPRK. Now, I think there is a substantive argument, in fact, for sanctions relief at this time. But I fear that the Russians are using this as a spoiling tactic to complicate diplomacy in the Council. So all in all, at least three of the five permanent members are behaving very badly. And that means that the Council is basically a nullity in discussions about COVID at the moment.
Now, these proposals that have been floated, the French proposed resolution, the Tunisian resolution that's being debated, these are primarily symbolic documents. They're calls for a sort of response, a collective response, but not necessarily laying out specific programmatic or policy addresses. Is that correct? And if so, are there discussions beyond the sanctions relief that you mentioned in regards to Russia about a specific policy response Security Council could or should be pursuing?
I think it's correct to say that most of the texts that have been discussed so far are largely symbolic. And I think it is worth emphasizing one thing. I've seen quite a few pieces in the US media and the European media over the last month suggesting that the Security Council could take a major coordinating role in the global public health response to this crisis, and that the Council could use its Chapter 7 powers to direct trade in medicine, for example. I mean, that is simply not on the agenda here in New York, and I don't think it should be on the agenda. You know, the Council is a diplomatic body that struggles to direct peacekeeping operations. There is no way that it can replace the WHO in terms of directing global public health operations. So the Council is really playing more of a political role. And I think that the most important political message it could send is that, firstly, the P5 are, you know, united in a common desire to see cooperation around the disease. And then more specifically, that they're going to focus on the challenges that peace operations are facing, the challenges that UN mediators are facing as a result of the disease, and that, you know, the big powers of the world are still thinking about peace and security issues, even if the vast majority of their attention is suddenly on health. I mean, it's worth saying, in addition to the problems that peacekeepers are facing, which Pam mentioned, UN mediators can't even fly around the Middle East at the moment. They can't get into places like Yemen because of COVID-based travel restrictions. That means that a lot of the peace processes that the Security Council has been backing up are going to falter. And so you want the Council to just send a clear message that it wants to support stability and security wherever it can. That's something which Secretary General Guterres has been talking about quite a bit in the context of his call for a global humanitarian ceasefire. And it's depressing that the Council isn't even able to come up with a broad call to support the SG's proposal, at least so far.
Well, let's move the conversation over to talk about Secretary General Guterres. Because we have seen other parts of the United Nations be more engaged on coronavirus issues than the Security Council has been thus far. We did see, it's worth noting, the General Assembly adopt another primarily symbolic resolution, I think several weeks ago now, urging a coordinated response to the coronavirus in an effort to sort of tee up some of these issues for the Security Council and for the Secretary General. At least that's my understanding. But Secretary General Guterres himself has really played a notable role, particularly in the last few weeks. Last week, we saw him roll out a major report on the likely social impact of the COVID-19 crisis, along with an associated response and recovery fund, kind of a mechanism that they're putting in place, with the notable line that you've already alluded to, Pamela, that he believes, and his advisors believe, that 10% of global GDP, about $9 trillion, will be needed to address the fallout from COVID-19. How has that proposal been received? How has it been acted upon, or does it project to be acted upon? And is it intended to really lay a blueprint for UN action, or is it more of either a symbolic action or a strategic step by the Secretary General to shape the diplomatic conversation around these sorts of issues?
It has received a great deal of positive support. This is the ceasefire and the idea of getting funds. So the UN Foundation, that was tapped by the World Health Organization, in 2 weeks came up with $100 million, and they're still fundraising. And so money is coming in, and it's coming in from nations, and it's coming in from the private sector, and it's coming from individuals. But where this is something that clearly each country cannot deal with by itself. Now, countries can close borders, but when you go to look at what the UN was founded for in 75 years ago, it was to create these nation states that would coordinate and see each other. So the era of diplomacy is not over, and it's necessary for a leader to try to bring that back when coronavirus, obviously any kind of virus, doesn't have a border. And there have been calls in the past, and the UN does have four coordinated efforts, and the UN does have experience with SARS, with HIV, with the flu. They've had experience with other major health crises and pandemics. Now, what's happened is the World Health Organization has done what the World Health Organization has usually does, and that's it studies it, it gives updates, it coordinates with other countries. But it has come under somewhat justified criticism for some of the delays. And we can get back to that in declaring a pandemic in the way they've dealt with this. At that moment that the World Health Organization seemed to be still going, but losing a little bit of its credibility, the Secretary General jumped right into that void. And it was really somewhat remarkable to all of us in UN headquarters who cover the Secretary General each day. He was very, very outspoken as the head of refugees for a decade. When he came into the chair as the Secretary General, he's been more diplomatic, if you will. This crisis has somehow totally transformed him. And what we've seen is the call for a ceasefire. And not only a call for a ceasefire, he keeps calling every country that he wants to lay down their arms. So just this past Friday, he said that over a dozen countries, now we have to be skeptical that this will last, but over a dozen countries will begin or continue the ceasefires. And he included fighters in Afghanistan, where the UN did come together to pass a Security Council resolution that backed up the Taliban peace deal and the U.S. Taliban peace deal, that is, in the U.S. Afghanistan peace deal. Now, Afghanistan has its own problems with two leaders still claiming the leadership, but this list, he listed Afghanistan, Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Colombia, Libya, Myanmar, Philippines, South Sudan, Sudan itself, Syria, Ukraine, and Yemen. And all of those countries, you're starting to see now some progress. What Guterres said is, let's have some actions, not just deeds, not just talk. But he really rose to the occasion saying, look, if we are going to try to get the masks and ventilators and aid, in addition to all the aid that's needed in places like Idlib or Yemen, where there's such a crisis because of the conflict, then you're going to have to try to show that you're going to make this a priority. And it's really been remarkable what's happened. Now, that was backed up by these two funds that Richard mentioned, you mentioned. One is the call for a fund that would be dedicated just to the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that's the $8 to $9 trillion, 10% of global GDP. And the previous one that you mentioned is for $2 billion to go to countries to try to help them recover from lost wages, the informal economy, unemployment, everything that's happening. So he's really coming to the fore. Now, even last night, he had a separate initiative on the problems with lockdown. Obviously, lockdown is really important, and that's what he said, and people staying at home. But that has seen a dramatic increase in domestic violence and violence against women. So he started that last night. Tomorrow, there's a health initiative, which is basically coming out of WHO, but on the state of nursing around the world. But the UN Secretary General seems to be having daily initiatives that are getting countries involved. So despite the fact that the Security Council seems a bit stalled as they've been, or more stalled because of coronavirus, the leadership at the UN seems to have jumped into the void.
Richard, let me follow up on the discussion about the ceasefire with you. Your organization, the International Crisis Group, released a report recently going over some of the impact that the coronavirus is likely to have on global conflicts, and including the potential needs for ceasefires in different places. And we have seen that call taken up and get a degree of public salience, as Pam described, including that the Secretary General seemed to endorse, at least bring awareness to, a public mobilization effort sponsored by the organization of VAAS, with this sort of global petition that has gotten a fair amount of attention in recent days, at least. What is your sense about how effective the ceasefire call has been, and what steps the SGA has taken, or he may need to take, to address some of the fallout that COVID is going to have for the traditional set of issues that the UN is based around, particularly the Security Council that the SGA is so involved in, those core international peace and security questions?
Well, I mean, I think, firstly, I would say that I completely agree that this has been an exceptionally good period for Guterres. I think he has been frustrated since taking office in 2017 that he has often sort of failed to shape the global narrative. Now he's still struggling to be heard because there's so much noise around the spread of the disease, but he is getting out some clear messages about how COVID is affecting peace and security and the likely economic effects of the disease. And I think he's showing a statesmanlike quality that is sadly lacking in a lot of national leaders, not least in the US. And that is playing to his advantage. So this has definitely been, for very brutal reasons, the high point of his leadership to date. If you look at the specifics of his global ceasefire call, it's not quite as promising as the recent UN report suggested. Quite a few armed groups have acknowledged the ceasefire call, and some have genuinely endorsed it. But in a few places, the results on the ground are minimal. I think the breakaway groups in eastern Ukraine, for example, acknowledged this call for a ceasefire, but actually violence continues at roughly the same level in Donbass as it did before. There's actually been a spike of violence in Yemen since the main players in the Yemeni conflict suggested they might agree to a ceasefire in response to Guterres. Something similar has happened in Libya. So the picture is still pretty murky. What I would say, though, is that Guterres has smartly laid out a framework for armed groups to de-escalate as the disease gets worse. We haven't really seen COVID wreak its full destruction in sub-Saharan Africa in particular. And I think if the disease does really spike in some conflict areas in Africa, you will see more armed groups suddenly turn to the UN and suddenly turn to the ceasefire call and endorse it in future. Similarly, the way he's been talking about the need for development is not really likely to actually shape the economic revitalization plans that G20 countries will eventually adopt post-COVID. But he's established himself as a very serious voice, especially speaking for the poorest when it comes to thinking about the economic effects of the disease. So I think Guterres has established himself as a really significant actor in addressing the crisis, even if the facts on the ground are sometimes a little bit shaky.
So another UN body that has come under some criticism in relation to the COVID crisis is the World Health Organization, or WHO, which you mentioned earlier, Pamela. Let me ask you, what is the source of that criticism? Where is it stemming from? To some extent, I know it relates to a slow reaction to the initial outbreak of the virus, then suspicions that that was inspired in part because of pressure from China or a fear of irritating China because of its relationship to the suspected origins or believed origins of the virus. But can you give us a sense about how WHO has adapted to that criticism to the extent they have, and if they, what role they're currently playing in responding to the crisis?
Right. Well, you laid it out pretty well, Scott. This has, the criticism has come from Capitol Hill in the United States. Florida Senator Rick Scott called for a congressional investigation. You've heard a lot of issues coming from the Congress in the United States and also from the White House and even from Dr. Fauci, who said, look, you know, the World Health Organization has been a partner. They called me recently. I called them back. We're figuring out how to deal with all of these other countries, too. But he said, if you look at the World Health Organization's history and don't criticize it, you're not really looking at the history. And so a very popular Dr. Fauci seemed to confirm a lot of people's questions about how the WHO has dealt with this. Now, you're also hearing it from different business groups. And the Wall Street Journal, for example, wrote from their editorial board that called it World Health Organization disinformation. And what the criticism is coming from is mainly the fact that both the doctor and health professionals within China were trying to get the word out as early as late December that there was this possible pandemic, that things were really bad with coronavirus. And he, of course, was arrested. Then Taiwan tried to do it and warned WHO on December, but they are not really a member because they're not a state party. And they sort of ignored that. And then the World Health Organization had its own meeting in late January debating whether to call it a public health emergency of international concern, which is really the step before a pandemic. And they didn't make that declaration until January 30th. Now, that meant that they lost at least a week of time. And now there are studies that say if they had gone earlier with the outbreak response and the characterization of the public health emergency and later the pandemic, which they knew about, that it could have reduced cases. And some of the studies, one by the University of Southampton, by 95%. So those studies vary. There's a lot of research being done, but the slowness of the response is the principal issue. Number two is the idea that everybody's trying to blame someone, and that's an unfortunate side effect of any crisis that is so tragic, where so many people are dying, and it just seems so fast. And people and countries, including the United States and municipalities, including New York, seem so overwhelmed and underprepared in terms of ventilators and hospital beds and even burying people. And so part of the problem is, why wasn't the United States, for example, I mean, as one of many, or Italy also, why wasn't the United States prepared? And so one of the reasons that people are looking at is the World Health Organization. And part of it is that it emanated in China. And so when there was pressure on Dr. Tedros to declare it this public health emergency, instead of looking at the research, he actually went to Beijing. And that slowed the process down also. So there's a lot to, I think people are seeing it as a little too much politics and not health per se than it should be. And so that's why people are worried about. And there was, of course, a lot of disinformation coming from China. Who knows if it still is, but it certainly was in the very beginning. So that's one of the main reasons. The World Health Organization, unfortunately, hasn't been seen as the place to go, because as soon as it did start, they did offer testing kits to countries, and the U.S. has been criticized for not actually taking them up on those tests, because after that, the CDC had its own problems and flaws in the tests that at first went out. So part of the issue is, why wasn't anyone prepared when there were warnings? And the World Health Organization has not stepped up as it should have.
Have some of these criticisms of the WHO we've heard particularly loudly in the right side of the political spectrum here in the United States been echoed elsewhere in the world or within the UN bodies? Is there a broader sense that there was something seriously wrong with how the WHO approached this that may need to be reformed? Or has it primarily been a criticism located in certain political audiences that might have a politically vested interest in it?
Well, the internal memo talking about need for money talked about the fact that the World Health Organization also seems to need funding for all that they're doing. So I think within the UN, the structure of management, there's not a lot of criticism of the WHO and what they're doing, because they're doing a lot of great things. I mean, one of the things they are doing is getting the message out around the world in countries that really can't afford to even have public service campaigns, and to try to get messages out about how social distancing, everything that we take for granted in a developed country, in the P5 countries all do, that they can't get in refugee camps or in conflict zones or in just impoverished countries around the world. And they have taken that lead. So there hasn't been as much criticism outside the United States. The United States also does support the WHO in terms of funding. And that hasn't, it had in the beginning of the Trump administration been cut back, but they've continued that funding now.
Richard, let me turn back to you to ask you maybe a little bit more of a meta question, one related more specifically to the United States. We've heard this crisis being described as, by Secretary General Guterres himself, I believe, as possibly or likely the most significant crisis the world has faced since World War II. For the United States, at least, the closest parallel for a lot of people has been the 9/11 attacks and the response to that, the experience that a transnational threat has resulted in major damage to the United States and continue to be a threat to the United States moving forward. After the 9/11 attacks, we saw the Bush administration, which, like the Trump administration, came into office fairly skeptical of UN institutions and retained some skepticism throughout, nonetheless embraced the UN Security Council in a number of ways, using them as a tool to adopt things like UN Security Council Resolution 1373 relating to counterterrorism, setting up a UN sanctions regime, ultimately turning to them to provide an international legal basis for the eventual occupation of Iraq, even though the initial invasion was not sanctioned by the Security Council. But we haven't seen that sort of engagement yet by the Trump administration. Is this a sign that the Trump administration is not willing or able to engage with the United Nations and other multilateral organizations? Do they just have too inherently vested of worldview that they're skeptical of it? Or are we likely to see a move in that direction as we get away from the immediate crisis and begin to move towards the very difficult task of organizing ourselves as a global community to responding to this sort of threat that does inherently cross national borders?
It's a good question. I hadn't really thought of the Iraq comparison, but you know, through the last few weeks, I've definitely been thinking of the contrast between what we're seeing at the moment and both the Obama administration response and actually the Bush administration response to the financial collapse in 2008, and then also the US role in fighting Ebola in West Africa in 2014. In both those cases, Washington turned to multilateral frameworks to handle major challenges. First Bush and then especially Obama, you know, really focused on responding to the 2008 crisis through the G20 and keeping China in particular, but also other non-Western economies on board in the G20 response. And I think that actually that turned out to be a fairly effective approach. In 2014, you know, the world responded late to Ebola, but nonetheless, the US actually turned to the Security Council and turned to the wider UN system to organize a pretty effective containment operation in West Africa when the scale of the challenge became obvious. So those were two global crises where the US definitely did adopt a UN set, well, a multilateral approach, and in the Ebola case, a UN-centric approach to response. This time around, we've seen nothing of the sort. As I mentioned earlier, the Trump administration seems more interested in taking this as an opportunity to bash China in the UN system. And that's been one of the main causes of paralysis in the Security Council, as I've said. I think this is not that surprising, sadly. For the last couple of years, we have really seen the Trump administration taking a very narrow view of the UN as a space to combat China. And that was partially associated with John Bolton, but it's also a line that Secretary of State Pompeo has pushed very hard on a number of occasions. And there's been a dissonance between the administration's pretty strong focus on limiting Chinese power in the UN and other multilateral forums, with the fact that overall it still continues to treat those forums with a high degree of disdain. And I think that this crisis is really showing up the inherent contradictions in that approach. It isn't meaningful for the US to try and marginalize China in the UN system if it's not really going to be able to lead in the UN system itself. And I think right at the moment, a lot of diplomats in New York are looking at Washington, they're looking to US, and they're just seeing a bit of a void. Now, in the absence of US leadership, the French are working very hard to get something in the Security Council. You know, even tiny countries like Liechtenstein played an important role in pulling together a General Assembly resolution. But without the US at the center of the UN response, it's not clear how much political credibility that the whole response can maintain.
Well, can I add something, Scott, to what Richard said? I mean,
please go ahead.
That is that it was really interesting, and I think something that did resonate with a lot of countries, especially the P5, when the Secretary General in the launch of this global fund said it's not only out of generosity that he's looking for money, but enlightened self-interest. And it seems like a bit of a cliche, but it's exactly what he and Mark Lowcock were trying to say, which is this multilateral institution may be better at least getting information out about a second wave and all of these other things that may have an impact when countries are just starting to look inward. He also cautioned against protectionist trade policy, something he doesn't usually do, echoing what the UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, had done in a study saying, look, this isn't the time to close trade, even if borders are closed, and to protect domestic product, but to make sure that the world is kept away from this most recent pandemic. And if you look at the international relations and major shifts from Westphalia creating states and then UN established after World War II with a lot in between, needless to say, there seems to be a new shift, a truly global one, that is looking at the UN and its affiliated bodies, including UNCTAD, UN Women, and UNICEF, and looking at them and saying, look, it may not only be states, and that is what may be out of date, the post-war P5 design, that it also has to deal with the Taliban as the last round of successful UN Security Council resolutions did. And it may have to do with rogue groups because they're players around the world in making conflict. So I think that will need, by the way, a return to face-to-face diplomacy on which the UN is very reliant. And so we'll see if they all do get to sit in the same room in late September for the General Assembly. I would say, back to the last question, just as a postscript, that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who now is in hospital because of the coronavirus, has reported that 10 Downing Street is rethinking U.S.-China ties over China's lack of candor about the coronavirus. And Japan has also been very annoyed at all of what's gone on in terms of misinformation coming from China and about the World Health Organization. So a very frustrated deputy prime minister in Japan called the WHO the Chinese Health Organization. So you are seeing the calls around the world to clean up the World Health Organization, but at the same time, I believe you're seeing more unity in returning to a multilateral framework because it may be cliche, but a virus has no borders. And so this may be a new round of multilateralism that includes other countries, territories, and groups in the future.
Actually, if I can jump in there too, Scott, I think it's an interesting point that, you know, on the one hand, the US is not leading. And as I say, I think a lot of other states are looking to Washington and seeing a void. But it also isn't clear to me that China is really succeeding in casting itself as an alternative multilateral leader at this moment, precisely because of some of the doubts and skepticism about Beijing's policies that Pam refers to. Since 2017, the Chinese have been working awfully hard and with some degree of success to present themselves as an alternative multilateral leader to the US on things like climate change. Now, actually, Beijing has already been encountering some pushback on that. because I think a lot of diplomats, including diplomats from the developing world, think that China is being a bit too greedy in, you know, taking big jobs in UN organizations and so forth. Now, Beijing is trying to present itself as a leader and trying to present itself as a humanitarian force, especially by shipping, you know, medical equipment to Europe and Africa and elsewhere. But I don't get a sense, listening to UN debates, that diplomats and other opinion makers feel that this is the moment where China replaces the US. Instead, you see the limitations of the US as multilateral power, but you are also still very aware of China's limitations as a multilateral power too. So, you know, Pam, I think, outlines a very optimistic vision of multilateralism reborn.
True.
I tend to see what you might call an acephalous, a headless world order, where no one power is capable of leading. And, you know, Guterres is trying to fill the void, doing, he said, I think, remarkably well, given the limitations he faces. But we just don't know whether that's enough.
Well, on that somewhat dour note, I think we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thank you both for joining us on the Lawfare podcast.
Thank you, Scott. Nice to speak with you, Richard.
Thank you. And I'm sorry to end on a downer. I'm sure that in a year from now, we'll have a completely revitalized UN and all will be well. But call us back then.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our producer was Jem Patya Howell, and our music was performed by Sophia Yan. Please be sure to rate the Lawfare podcast wherever you found us and share us on Twitter and other social media. As always, thank you for listening.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.